That was Ruth chapter 1. As we're making our way through the entire Bible over the course of this and next year, we've come to, I think, my favorite book in all the Old Testament. If you were here back in 2009, we spent 7 weeks in the book of Ruth, and I shared with my wife that I think this may be the most difficult study to get done in a single morning thus far. And it's only got 85 verses. I would like to just kind of set it in its stage. If you look at it historically, it takes place during the time of the judges, and it provides this really nice tie back to the time of the judges where wickedness abounds, but it also begins to cast our eyes forward to the coming king. It will end, in fact, with the word David. It is an incredible opportunity to tie these two together, but I think it also stands as this lovely reminder. If you were here last week, we talked a little bit about the theological perspective where the book of Judges falls and this promise that God has given to Abraham that all the world would be blessed through him, including even a Gentile little girl named Ruth. I think in order to understand the book of Ruth, you really need to understand a lot of what we studied. And if we had time, I would love to go back and kind of build the case. If you want to understand why there was a famine, Moses is going to share that when you turn from God, you should expect a famine. He shares the condemnation of intermarriage and the struggles that it will bring, the evils of idolatry. And as you come to chapter 2, then we move to this whole subject of gleaning. What exactly is Ruth doing going out into the field that isn't hers? Why does God care for the widows and the foreigners like he does? You're introduced to this greeting that goes right over top of our head when Boaz arrives in his field. It's actually taken straight out of Numbers chapter 4. There's the whole idea of taking shelter under God's wings. Maybe the most difficult thing for us in the 21st century to get our hands around is this levirate marriage. You mean if my brother dies without children, I have a moral obligation to marry his wife and have kids? What about this kinsman redeemer? In fact, the most mysterious is in chapter 4 when land is bought, they take off a sandal. Why? Go back and read Deuteronomy chapter 25 and you get a little better idea. But this morning, my whole desire is to take a really quick survey of the book. Let me rephrase that. As quick a survey as I can get through, and then I just want to leave you with a couple thoughts. But the book begins, actually, if you just look one verse earlier, it says that this is during the time of the judges. Well, the judges was a horrible period. A time when everyone did whatever they thought was good. We were confronted last week how the temptation placed before Adam and Eve was, do I choose God's good or my own good? And from that moment on, humanity has continued to reject God's definition of good and to try and substitute their own. That becomes no more obvious than in the period of the judges. And we're told that this very book begins in the time of judges. And there was a famine in the land. Moses had pretty clearly laid out what was the response God desired when famine came. He said that when famine comes, if you will turn back from your sins, turn back from the gods that you are worshiping and return to me, I will send water for your fields. I will send fruit from the land. But what is Elimelech's response? Elimelech, whose name, as you go through the book of Ruth, everybody's name seems to play a pretty important role. He says, my God is king. And yet, rather than turning back to God, he runs from God and he goes into the land of Moab and he hopes that it's only going to be for a while. I'm often amazed how oftentimes we think we're taking a short little path that is only a while, but Elimelech never returns. I'm convinced it was his idea. We'll just go for this season. We'll get some food. We'll fill up. I know it's not the place to go. I mean, after all, Moab, go back and read about Moab. Lot has an incestual relationship with his daughters and has the son Moab. You come forward and that whole story about Balaam and that bizarre episode is from Moab. Chapter 25 of Numbers, Moab sends out their most beautiful women to seduce the Israelites. And as a result, 24,000 Israelites die in a single day. There were few places that were more despised by the Jews than Moab. But that's where Elimelech goes. He goes in search of food and nothing goes well. He dies. We don't know exactly the context. We're told they were there for 10 years. Does Elimelech die immediately? Does sickly and tiny? I mean, Malian and Chilean, do they have problems? Do they die right away? We're not told, but finally, Naomi decides it's time to return. And as she gets back home, she says, please don't call me Naomi, the pleasant one. From now on, call me the bitter one. And can you blame her? I mean, think about her life. She's lost everything. She's lost her husband. She's lost her two sons. She's lost everything. The word widow in the Hebrew language comes from two words that have the idea of without a voice. In fact, a widow in ancient Hebrew culture had absolutely no rights. By the end of the book, you're going to find out that Naomi owns land, but she has no legal right to it because she's a widow. And without a man in her life, she can't even profit off that which is hers, because that was the life of a widow. And she returns, but I think there's, if we had time, I'd love to explore this whole idea of bitterness. Bitterness is a dangerous thing that some of us might be struggling with. In fact, if you're not careful, bitterness is going to blind you. She says that she had nobody for Ruth and Orpah to marry. It wasn't true. She knew it wasn't true. You'll see she knew it wasn't true when you come to chapter 2 and chapter 3. She remembers there are kinsmen who could marry you. There are opportunities, but she can't see it. But to me, the most amazing part, she says that I went away full. Really? You had no money, no food. You left trying to find some place to live. You went away full and you came back empty. I'm sorry. Who is that that's clinging to your side? In fact, all of Naomi's answers are found in the person of Ruth. But Naomi can't even see her. In fact, she'd done her best to chase her away. Orpah turns back. I went down to Missouri this week to watch Abigail in a play, and so I spent about 12 hours in the car, and I'm not a music guy, and so I had sermons on, and I found an interesting sermon on the book of Ruth from a Hebrew rabbi. They had all kinds of ideas that I don't even know where they came up with it, and Orpah turns back, and most would say was gone to history. That's not what Hebrew tradition suggests. Orpah gets married, has a son, who has a grandson you may have been familiar with, according to Hebrew tradition, a guy by the name of Goliath. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but it is an interesting perspective. Orpah's gone, but Ruth stays with her. Why does Ruth stay with her? Well, the author puts it this way, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you will stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. It's lost in English, but this is a beautiful Hebrew poem. Hebrew poems aren't so much concerned about rhyming as English poems are. They oftentimes will have this beautiful acrostic, and if you were to read it in Hebrew, you would find it as four beautifully parallel lines. And as is typically the case, the poem points you to the middle. The two outside verses, line 1 and 5 match, line 2 and 3 match. And they point you to the very middle. And the very middle of that line is the phrase, your God will be my God. Why does Ruth leave Moab? I can't fully suggest what that was like. This is a young Jewish girl choosing to take up residence in Berlin in the 1930s. This is somebody going to a place where she knows she will be hated. She suspects a life of pain and suffering. Why would she go? Because there was something about Naomi's God that she so desperately wanted to serve. You come to chapter 2 then, and as you come to chapter 2, you begin to see things are about to turn. Suddenly we're introduced to the next main character, a guy by the name of Boaz. And it's interesting, verse number 1 really doesn't need to be there. The author, a master author, I'd encourage you to go through, and it's fascinating. Almost every verse 1 and last verse of a chapter either points you back or points you forward. He's going to say Boaz was a man of standing. What in the world does that mean? Well, some of the translations take a little liberty with it, and rather than just translating it, they interpret it for you. That word, a man of standing, is used in three different ways in the Old Testament. You have to determine from the context which it means. The first way in the book of Judges is it's used to speak of a war hero. It's used of Gideon as he comes back after defeating Midian. And he was a man of standing. He was somebody who certainly was respected. Other places, it's used to speak of a man of high, noble character that was a prominent, important figure in his society. The way that it's oftentimes translated is it spoke of a man who had great wealth. I love the author, whoever it is that wrote Ruth, because he provides just enough detail for you to get an idea of the picture, but leaves enough ambiguity in it for you to fill in the blanks with your imagination. I suspect Boaz was all three. He lived during the time of Judges where there were constant battles. It wouldn't be at all surprising that he was a war hero. He certainly was a man of means, as he's going to have the ability to simply buy a field when it comes for sale. He was clearly respected. He was a man of great standing, but a man of intense piety. He arrives in his chrome-colored covered chariot, gets off the chariot, heads to the factory of his field, and his greeting is just like your boss's tomorrow. Lord be with you! And everybody stands from their cubicle and says, the Lord bless you! That's how it goes at your workplace, isn't it? This is the Levitical greeting that one expected to be given when you arrived at the tabernacle. If you went to the tabernacle, the priest or the Levite would greet you by saying, the Lord be with you. And you were expected to respond, the Lord bless you. Think about that just for a second. Boaz considered his workplace a place of worship. Do you consider your workplace a place of worship? I fear that far too often we have this idea that worship is something we do from 10 to 11 o'clock Sunday mornings, and then the rest of the week we do whatever we need to. I would suggest that God's intent is that worship is something we do all day. And you watch as Boaz viewed this as important as going to the tabernacle. And thus he throws out this greeting and he instantly notices this little girl. I don't know if she looked different. She was a Moabite, not a Jew. She could have looked different. I don't know if she's dressed different. She was a widow. Maybe she was dressed in the widow garb. Maybe he knew all of his employees well and just recognized that there's something wrong. But he comes up to his fromer and says, who is that little girl? And it's easy for this to go over your head. She is a Moabitess. May I suggest insert racial slur here. He wasn't saying kind things about Ruth. To call someone a Moabitess was a racial slur towards her. She's a Moabitess. But that's not what Boaz hears. Boaz hears that she is one who came with Naomi. In fact, as you begin to translate it, that last phrase in the verse, she went into the field and worked steadily from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. That's the most difficult phrase in the entire book to translate. I would like to translate it a little differently. She has come and worked steadily from morning till now. She has made the field like her own house. She just simply worked and worked and worked. And so Boaz approaches her and he says to Ruth, my daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another man's field. Don't go away, but stay here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow after the girls. I told the men not to touch you. Go back and read the last three chapters of Judges. What could a young lady by herself expect? In the period of the Judges, she could expect to be molested, to be beaten, to maybe even be left dead. But Boaz says, you don't need to worry about that in my house. I've instructed all of the guys that they're not to touch you. And please feel free to go wherever you want. The idea of gleaning was something that God had put into the law to care for the poor. He had said that you were to not harvest the corners of your field. And if any grain hit the ground, you were not allowed to pick it up. That was for those who had nothing else to come. But number one, we're talking about the period of the Judges. I'm guessing lots of people didn't follow the law. But number two, what exactly is a corner? Is you go back and read, you'll find that a lot of farmers decided the corner was one stalk in each corner. I'm leaving the corner. See, there's one wheat kernel there. You could spend hours and not even get a meal. And yet Boaz says, go ahead, go work right behind the men, and if you get thirsty, go and drink the water from the jars of men. They didn't have running water. Most likely, they had to bring the water from town out to the field, carrying it in jars. Are you excited about somebody coming up to your work and just profiting off it for no other reason than she can? But Boaz says, let her drink. In fact, he goes as far at mealtime. He says, come over here and have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar. And she sat down with the harvesters and he offered her some roasted grain. And she ate all that she wanted and had some left over. And as she got up to glean, Boaz gave the orders to his men. Even if she gathers among the sheaves, don't embarrass her. Rather, pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up. And don't rebuke her. He says, don't embarrass her in any way. In fact, as she finishes gleaning until evening, she threshes all of it. And when she leaves, she has an ephod of grain. Now, the measurements in the Old Testament are difficult to follow, and we're not always 100% sure what they are. But scholars would suggest that an ephod of grain was someplace between 30 and 50 pounds of wheat, of barley. To put it in perspective, the average worker was paid 2 pounds of barley a day. This gleaner, who often would have expected maybe a meal, comes home with an entire month's worth of grain. It's not because she was so industrious. It's because Boaz went out of his way to treat the least of society kindly. I know that one of the struggles you have when you're reading a familiar story is you are reading it from chapter 4 backwards. Boaz has a thing for her. She's really attractive. She's a really nice-looking young girl, and he has a romantic interest. I don't think that was the case. In fact, I was this week trying to think of what Ruth would have been like, and the fact that she had married a Jew probably suggests that she wasn't somebody who all kinds of quarters were lining up to have as a wife. In fact, I would suggest that there stands a very good possibility she was not what everybody wanted in a wife. But Boaz was simply interested in caring for the least. May I suggest that you give an incredible insight into who you are with how you treat the least in society? How do you treat the person at the Walmart checkout that's taking way too long? How do you deal with the person at the restaurant that screws your order up? See, too often we think, I don't have to be nice to them. Ruth had no reason to be treated kindly other than Boaz loved his God. And his God loved her. And so did he. And Boaz replies and he says, I've been told all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband and how you left your father and your mother and your homeland and you came to live with a people you did not know. I don't have time for rabbit trails, but I'm going to take one anyway. The book of Ruth is fascinating because in almost every chapter you're going to see a prayer offered. And the fascinating thing about the prayers is never once are any of the prayers offered for themselves. It's always offered for someone else. The prayer in every single case is answered before the book ends. But what I find really fascinating, Boaz is going to pray for Ruth. May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel. What is he saying? He's saying, I pray that God will give you a husband, that he will give you children, that he will give you resources. How is that prayer answered? Boaz becomes all those things to Ruth. May I suggest that one of the purposes of prayer is not just to move the heart of God. I'm convinced that often God's heart is moved to move your heart to action. Maybe you are the answer you're praying for. And so we come to chapter number 3. And in chapter 3, there's this difficult story to figure out. I wish I could tell you I fully understand exactly what's going on. We know that Naomi comes to Ruth and she says, "My daughter-in-law, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for? Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman?" This whole idea of a kinsman redeemer is so beautifully illustrated that if you go back to the law, you will find that God had made a provision that the land wasn't yours, it was his. He simply allowed you to farm it, to make profit off it, and that meant that he could give it to whomever he wanted to. And so on the 50th year of Jubilee, the land always went back to its original owners. If you came into great financial struggles, you could sell your land. But if a relative didn't have to, but if a relative took pity upon you, he could take his money and buy it back for you. He could redeem the land for you. And she says, "We know that Boaz is this redeemer. Tonight I want you, they're going to be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourself. Put on the best clothes." Once again, don't read 21st century understanding into that. Water was a scarcity in Israel. They didn't bathe often. In fact, you may only bathe a couple times in your life. Don't get this idea that she's supposed to dress up in her finest clothes. That word best clothes, one of the few places that phrase is used is in 2 Samuel when David has a child by Bathsheba and Nathan comes and says that child will die. And David spends days praying, refuses to eat, refuses to get off his bed. He begs God. And then when the child dies, David does exactly this. He washes himself, he changes his clothes, and he goes to the tabernacle. I think the point that Naomi is saying is, Ruth, it's time to get over Chilion. Change your clothes. Move on with life. It's time to find a new husband. And so she goes and she says, "Go to the winnowing floor, and in the middle of the night, uncover his feet." I don't have any idea what exactly is going on. I don't think anybody else does, but she does exactly what she's told. In the middle of the night, suddenly something startles the man and he turns and he discovers a woman laying at his feet. Remember the time. It's the judges, when everybody did what was good in their own eyes. One of the most common places to find a prostitute in that particular time was on the winnowing floor, because she knew you had money and you could pay for her services. Boaz wakes up and suddenly he sees a woman. What does she want? Who is she? Ruth was about to step out into the deep, because Boaz could easily have stood up and described her as a prostitute and at that moment had her stoned. Boaz could decide, "What are you talking about? I was just trying to be nice. I don't have any interest in a relationship with you. Get out of here." She was risking everything. What would Boaz do? And her mother-in-law said, "Uncover his feet and do whatever he says." Ruth decides to take a different tack. She says, "I am your servant, Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment." It's not the best translation. It's literally, "Spread the wings of your garment." Back in chapter 2, verse 12. Boaz praises Ruth because she has chosen to take shelter under the wings of the Almighty. Ruth now says, "Boaz, would you be God's wings for me?" And Boaz is impressed by her faith, impressed by her. She says, "Lord bless you, my daughter. The kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men." I don't know what Boaz looked like. If you ever go to any of the children's books, you will find a strapping young man, an amazing specimen. I wonder if he wasn't a bald, somewhat plump, bow-legged guy who was well past his prime. I don't know. He clearly wasn't a young man. But he says, "I praise you. Now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you as you have asked. All of my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of character." In our Bible, the book of Ruth follows the book of Judges. I think you know that. We're going through it in order. We were in Judges last week. That means Ruth is next. If you go to the Hebrew Bible, that's not where the book of Ruth shows up. It's not in the historical section. It's in what the Hebrews call the writings. We would call it the prophetic sessions. In fact, it follows immediately the book of Proverbs. Do you know how the book of Proverbs ends? If you go to the very end, my Bible has titles for the different paragraphs. It says an epilogue, the wife of noble character, and beginning in verse 10, all the way through the end of the chapter, the proverbist desires to show us what a woman of character looks like. You want to see it in real life? Look at Ruth. In fact, it's a beautiful picture that Ruth becomes this woman of noble character. And so she lays at his feet until morning. He gets up and then he goes ahead and he gives her six measures of barley. And Ruth comes back to his mother-in-law and she says, Boaz had done for me. And he added, he gave me six measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law. Do you remember what she said in chapter 1? I came back empty-handed. Boaz said, tell her she will never be empty-handed again. Take some food with you. And so we move into chapter 4, but before we get there, do you like to wait? One of the most amazing things to me is that faith requires a couple steps. It requires the willingness to risk, but it almost always involves the willingness to wait. In fact, when would Boaz go to the town? I don't know. Next week? I mean, we got to get this grain. He's sleeping out under the stars with his grain. He's so scared somebody's going to take it that he doesn't even leave it. So he spends the night there. He's going to get it all done, put it away, get it properly sold, stored. He'll get around to you someday, Ruth. Faith oftentimes requires us to wait. And waiting almost never gives us an end. It's one thing when you know you have to wait till tomorrow. But what happens if you wait till next year? Till next decade? The rest of your life? When is Boaz going to act? I don't know. But chapter 4 comes along and you see this incredible demonstration, not just of Boaz's kindness, but he goes, and I wish we had time. You're introduced to Mr. So-and-so. The author doesn't even want to tell us his name, so he just makes up a name. It's Mr. So-and-so has the rights, and in this beautiful twist and turn, he has a chance to buy it. And he says, yeah, I'll take the land. Oh, don't forget, you got to have the woman too. Then I'm not interested. You can have it. And so Boaz takes and he receives the land, and he says to everybody, to the elders and all those at the gate, that you are my witnesses. And they respond, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. Why do you suppose he goes back to Rachel and Leah? I don't know for certain, but I do know that they lived in Moab for 10 years and had zero children. Do you remember the story of Rachel? She was Jacob's favorite wife and couldn't have children. Could it be that Ruth also was barren? And they were praying that God would open her womb and that she would be as prosperous and her offspring would give you the young woman. May your family be like that of Perez and Tamar. So Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. And then he went into her and the Lord enabled her to conceive. It's fascinating. The narrator will tell God did two things in this story. Provided food, chapter 1. Provided a child in chapter 4. May I suggest the things that we most quickly take credit for are providing food for ourselves to eat, and producing children. You didn't do either one. God did them both. He enables her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And the woman said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel, and he will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, is better for you than 7 sons. Has given birth. There's lots of things that I could take, but in just a couple minutes we don't have, let me see if I can just throw out 2. One of the things that really amazes me, and one of the reasons I have fallen in love with the book of Ruth so much, is because you don't read any miracles. Jericho, it falls by a miraculous hand of God. Moses parts the Red Sea. Joshua parts the Jordan River. You'll come. David's going to slay Goliath. And it's so easy sometimes to think that God only works through the miraculous. Not once is there a single miracle in the book of Ruth. But does God show up? In chapter 2, I love the way the author puts it. She goes out to do her gleaning, and she just happened to come to Boaz's field. Was that really blind luck? This past summer, Danny and Abigail worked up at Village Creek. And Abigail is down at SBU, and in order to go down there, she had to go down in the middle of the summer for freshman orientation. And so one week, in fact, it was the week we had VBS here, she took off Friday and headed home, and then Renee and she went down on Saturday down to SBU. It was about 7:30 at night when I get this panicked phone call from her. Our car, we don't have brand new cars. One of the tires leaks a little bit around the rim. And so I tried really hard to tell the kids, you can't go on a long trip without checking the air. So she had left Village Creek, had driven into Waukon, gone to the gas station, checked the tire, noticed it was low. So she got the air hose, and in an attempt to fill up the tire, she broke the stem on the tire. To make matters worse, she had somehow managed to get the hose of the air hose close enough to the car so that when the tire entirely lost air, it came to rest on top of the hose. And she calls me and says, Dad, what do I do? Well, it took me about 15 minutes to even understand what she was talking about. And I'm sitting here running through my head, what in the world do I do? She's 3 hours away. It's already almost 8 o'clock at night. I'm not sure I can drive all the way up there and help her. And as we're talking, it just so happens a truck parks next to her. It just so happens it's an older gentleman who was a mechanic. It just so happens that he saw her in need and asked her if she needed help. It just so happened he knew exactly what to do. It just so happened he had a spare stem in his car. It just so happened he had the tools to change the tire. It just so happens that everything took care of itself. Blind chance? No. I don't know that that gentleman will ever know it, but he was God's answer to a stressed out father 150 miles away. And all he did was the same thing he had done thousands of times. Fixed a tire that was flat. May I suggest that you and I don't always see it. In fact, I would suggest as you come to chapter 1, there was nothing good Ruth or Naomi could see. But God was at work. And by the end of the story, you begin to see that God was not only at work, but he gave in the most glorious of fashions possible. I love the way the author ends the book. I don't know if you've seen the animated film Ants. It's a Woody Allen presentation. It's about this worker ant who falls in love with the queen ant. And he goes through all of these things to try and win her. He finally does. And as the story ends, the camera begins to pan back. And you begin to see that they're inside an anthill, inside a park inside Central Park in New York City. That's what this author does. Ruth has a baby whose name happens to be Obed, who has a baby whose name happens to be Jesse, who has a baby that happens to be David. Ruth changes the world by doing the very next thing. Why did God treat Ruth so kindly? I'm convinced the answer is in verse number 12 of chapter 2. When everything else around her fell apart, the only thing she had was God's wing. And when she grasped onto his wing with all her energy, she found out that God's wing was all she needed. See, I'm afraid in the society that we live, when we have so many things, when we have so many material possessions, distractions, that sometimes we can begin to think that we've got it under control. In fact, I think if you were to have sat down with Ruth at the end of her life, she would tell you the greatest thing that ever happened to her was losing her husband in Moab. Even though it was painful beyond description, God used that event to bring her to himself. I don't know if you're a music person or not. I'm not. When you came in this morning, there was a song playing on the speakers. Often I'll go to a restaurant or a mall and my kids will say, or my wife will say, "Do you hear that song?" And I will say, "What song?" Well, it just so happened that song was "Your Love, O Lord, Reaches to the Heavens." I played it during the offering. In fact, as we read, I am more convinced than ever that this song, taken straight out of Psalm 36, isn't Psalm 36. See, I'm convinced that David is sitting out watching his sheep one evening, dreaming about the stories that Grandpa Obed had told him, and told him about his incredible mother who had nothing but God. And David would never get over that in the midst of unimagined wickedness, God's love flowed. As we close this morning, would you sing with me, "Your Love, O Lord"?